Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program David Swanson. He's author, activist, and journalist, host of the Talk Nation radio program. He's director of the WorldBeyondWar.org and campaign coordinator of RootsAction.org. War is a Lie is one of David's recent books, and we're very happy to have you here tonight, David, to talk about a recent delegation trip you took to Cuba. Thanks for joining us, David.
Hi, Scott. Glad to be here.
So, you joined Code Bank for a recent delegation to Cuba, and as I understand, it was your first trip to Cuba. Is that correct?
It was, yeah.
So, you're a Cuban virgin, and this all happened, of course, in the wake of the Obama administration's announcement of moves towards normalizing diplomatic relations with Cuba after, you know, some 60 years of a freeze and the battle to overthrow Fidel Castro and his government over all these many decades, and including assassination attempts. But David, maybe you could speak to what got your interest to travel down to Cuba and your first impressions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think toward normalization of relations is the key word there, because there's nothing normal about it whatsoever. I mean, the United States is intent on overthrowing the Cuban government or radically altering it. I mean, it is attempting different tools toward those ends. And if the result ends up being ultimately normal relations in the sense of respectful, collegial, open relationships between two nations as equals, it will be almost accidental, because that's not where they're headed. I mean, the United States has a chunk of the island of Cuba at Guantanamo that it uses for the most awful crimes, and has absolutely no interest in ever giving it back. I mean, it's not even on the radar screen. Cuba may come off the so-called terrorist list of nations, which it ironically is on, as you mentioned, all these decades of U.S. and U.S.-supported terrorism against Cuba, with the assassination attempts on Castro being the least of it, and open terrorists living openly in Florida with U.S. protection. And the moves that we're seeing now include proposals from the State Department for what Cuba should be allowed to import and export with the United States. And everything that they're proposing it be allowed to export to the United States is anything privately made. So anything that the government of Cuba has had any role in producing is forbidden, not up for consideration on the list. So this is a new tool for giving support to privatization of the Cuban economy, whether the Cuban government or the Cuban people want that or not, which puts us in this weird situation where, you know, 150 of us went down there and we could bring back, each could bring back hundreds of dollars worth of goods, including rum and cigars, but we couldn't bring back life-saving and limb-saving medicines that Cuba has created and nations around the world are using because the Cuban government was involved. So after we got back, we set up this petition, Code Pink and Roots Action, where I work, so you can find it at rootsaction.org, telling the State Department and the Treasury Department, which makes the regulation, to let the U.S. bring in and test and use medicines. Every 7 minutes in the United States, someone with diabetes loses a limb to amputation. Wouldn't happen with a medicine from Cuba, but we can't have it because it's more important to privatize the Cuban economy. So it's still a very, very bizarre relationship, and yet you go there and everyone is thrilled to see you, can't believe you're there. Oh my goodness, and a real live American, how did this happen? And they're very, very friendly and very, very eager for closer relations.
Well, thanks for that. I want to talk about the medicine boycott that continues, as you say, and the critical pharmaceuticals produced in Cuba and what they could do to help people here and the obstacles. But before we get there, David, what were some of the concerns you heard from people in Cuba that you spoke with about the directions that this normalization, if it does proceed, the turns it could take?
Well, it's, you know, it's not as if every Cuban is completely happy with their government, right? And there are many complaints, and there's dissent, and there are protests, and there are grievances, and there are endless shortcomings. But the justification that the Cuban government has traditionally used and still uses for any of its shortcomings is the aggressive hostility of the United States. And that's been a reality, and that's popularly understood as well. And so Cuban people that we talk to are eager for more open relations, but are worried about the intentions of the United States and how it will play out and whether it will look like it looked before the Cuban Revolution, with a lot of the wealth of Cuba in the hands of foreigners, and they're worried that the safety net, as we call it up here, but the human rights to education and housing and income and food that they have in Cuba will be tossed aside. It would be wonderful to see Cuba manage to negotiate and maneuver into open and friendly exchanges of goods and culture and human exchanges with the United States and the rest of the world. They call the embargo a blockade because the United States is blocking other countries from trading with Cuba as well, while still maintaining the supports that hold up everyone in Cuba who has a right to food and housing and education and so forth that people in the United States don't have. And so you see poverty in Cuba, and you see that it's a poor country, but it's not a poor country by Latin American standards. It has done remarkably well despite the blockade, and there are people very much concerned that you will see a rise in inequality, and you will see guaranteed rights go by the wayside. We visited a school for doctors where they bring would-be doctors, students, medical students from other countries around the world, including the United States, and give them a top-notch medical education for free, because education is free in Cuba, and send them back to their countries just with the encouragement that they go and work where their services are most badly needed. It would be nice to have people in the United States learn about a country that's just off our shores where you can go to school for free and ask why, with our wealth, we can't do the same. And when you ask people in the Cuban government, members of parliament and so forth, why the United States has had this attitude toward Cuba, this is the number one explanation they give, and they may not be wrong. The United States government does not want its people to know that this other form of politics is possible.
We're speaking with David Swanson, longtime activist and journalist and author, and we're talking tonight about a Code Pink delegation that he was on recently where he visited Cuba. And, David, were there any memorable conversations that you had about the issue of freedom of expression? Apart from the economics, the United States has long criticized and condemned Cuba for the lack of freedom of speech, quote-unquote, and there's a lot of discussion, as you mentioned earlier, where the Cuban government uses the hostility of the United States to justify a crackdown on dissent. And was there any sense from people you spoke with that that some kind of easing of relations between the U.S. and Cuba could open up space for legitimate independent dissent, which, of course, exists in every country in the world. But, you know, the particular situation people find themselves in Cuba is somewhat different. Tell our listeners if there's anything that you heard that indicates people are looking forward to some kind of normalization, if it should occur, that would open up space for them.
Certainly there are, and certainly there are people we spoke to who think that that matters will improve, that there will be greater access to the internet, you know, and there are people in Havana who have set up their own local internet for lack of greater access to the wider one, and so forth. There are protesters who have a very hard time protesting. One of the better stories I heard was of a group of protesters who would protest in a particular place on a particular day, and the government would send a very talented and exciting musical band to go and march down the street and drag the crowd away with them, taking everyone's attention away from the protest, which I would much prefer as a technique to what I face in Washington, D.C. sometimes. But I think that to the extent that the excuse of U.S. funding and infiltration and to the extent that the Cuban government is no longer able to say you aren't a dissenter, you're a mercenary, real dissent will be able to identify itself as such. And this is the problem when the United States is putting tens of millions of dollars every year through USAID and so forth into creating up fake Twitter programs in order to propagandize Cubans, and funding bloggers and activists who do what the U.S. government wants them to do and say what they're told to say, is that the Cuban government says that's what everyone who has a complaint is actually funded by the U.S. government. If that were to end, you know, and I sat in what is soon to be the U.S. Embassy, is, you know, currently the U.S. interest section, and asked the number two guy in charge there, you know, what if the Cuban government were funding peace and justice activists in the United States? He and his colleagues said to us, we would have absolutely no problem with that, but it's different because we have free speech and they don't. And I said, yes, but the United States has troops in 175 nations and more wars than it can keep track of, and Cuba doesn't. What if Cuba took an interest in peace activism in the United States? And they said, oh, no problem whatsoever. But, of course, the problem is that you would be working with a terrorist state. Cuba is on the list of terrorist states, and were anyone in the United States to work with Cuba, for whatever noble or humanitarian reason or otherwise, you would get yourself accused of terrorism.
No, that's an important point to make, and that is the funding that, as you mentioned, the United States has set up these covert Twitter accounts to encourage dissent, and we just had the release of a U.S. State Department official there who was distributing computers that were outside the law in Cuba, and dozens or hundreds of other covert actions that have been taken against the government in Cuba. So that sounds like, if space could be opened up for legitimate independent dissent, makes perfectly a good future. But, you know, David, I wanted to ask you more about the medical issues, because I think many of our listeners are aware that Cuba has a very unique pharmaceutical and medical industry. They've sunk a lot of resources as well as human capital into developing unique ways to combat tropical diseases and other common maladies faced, as you said a moment ago, such as diabetes that afflict many on the island, but everywhere in the world these drugs could be useful. Maybe you could spell out for our listeners a little bit about the innovation that you learned about in Cuba with pharmaceuticals and medical techniques that could be useful here in this country and elsewhere, but are not being allowed through our borders.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's not a question of whether the U.S. government thinks rum and cigars are better for us than life-saving medicines and vaccines and medical techniques that have been developed by Cuba and tested and approved in numerous other countries around the world. It's a decision that it is more important to the U.S. government that anything produced with aid from the Cuban government it be shut down, and that anything created by a private entrepreneur in Cuba be encouraged and supported. So this is the goal, which takes precedence over life and limb, not just of foreigners, but of U.S. citizens, men, women, and children in the United States who have illnesses and diseases. And so it was, you know, that was rather shocking. And we asked the staff at the U.S. Embassy about that sort of prioritization, as well as how Cuba's human rights record could possibly be compared to those of places like Saudi Arabia or Egypt or other places that the United States funds and arms and supports and defends, and they just had no answers and seemingly no concern, which was rather disturbing. We also went to Cuban farms, organic farms, where they have invested perhaps even more in terms of scientific research into how to restore the minerals and nutrients to soil in which to grow food, that will lead to people not ever contracting the sorts of diseases that we spend so much time trying to cure. And so that was very interesting. I'm neither a doctor nor a farmer, but there clearly was a great deal of expertise in Cuban farming, and this was something that was developed out of necessity when the Soviet Union collapsed and Cubans were starving and didn't have that foreign support and needed to grow more of their own food. They out of absolute necessity, they developed techniques that appear to be absolutely essential if we are going to move to a sustainable way of feeding and caring for ourselves.
David, when you were in Cuba and talking with ordinary people as well as officials and educators and such, did you get a sense that there was a lot of concern about huge changes that could occur with the influx of U.S. corporate investment in the island nation, given that that certainly has changed the face of many countries around the world when that flood of U.S. dollars comes into a nation that is not prepared. Do you get a sense that people are concerned, and are they prepared, you think, to deal with that and certainly protect the programs that work well for the majority of people in Cuba?
That is very much the concern, and flood is the sort of word that is used, and I couldn't recall the phrase capitalist tsunami being thrown around quite a bit. But there's a tremendous confidence in the Cuban government for all of its flaws and failings being completely up to this task. That is, that the Cuban government is not going to immediately or recklessly sacrifice its most important programs, and even more so that it's not going to allow majority foreign ownership of anything, that it is going to maintain Cuban control with minority foreign investment in anything, and it's not going to allow foreign companies or foreign countries to take control. There is of course a great deal of resentment in Cuba and interest in getting the United States out of Guantanamo, which it of course has no legal right to, was seized by force over a century ago. But again, on these other topics, on political prisoners, on trade items, on opening up of different aspects of governance and exchange, the staff at the embassy is full of intricate decisions and dialogue. They're obviously working in all of these areas. When you talk to them about Guantanamo, they know nothing about it. They can't name the treaty in which it was seized. They can't tell the history. They have false beliefs about the lease running out someday, which is it's not going to unless something has changed. It's just not on their radar screen at all. So there's a definite gap on that issue.
Well, we're just about out of time here, David. I want to make sure that our listeners, if they're not following your writings right now, they should know where to find them. So give us the web addresses of some of your blogs and some of the organizations you work with, especially mention, again, if you would, the Roots campaign, where you're trying to get some blockade of this medicine and pharmaceuticals lifted.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Rootsaction.org is where to find that petition put up by us and Code Pink. You can also check out CodePink.org if you want to go on their next trip to Cuba, which they are planning as we speak. And my website is DavidSwanson.org.
DavidSwanson.org. Appreciate your sharing some of your thoughts on this Cuba trip, David, and I think people should follow you on Twitter and social media and visit the blog. You're writing about something new and interesting and important just about every single day, so people would be wise to follow you and check out some of the things you're working on. But thank you so much for making the time to join us, David, and we'll look forward to the next time we talk.
I really appreciate it, and fund this station.
Thank you. Thanks for the pitch. Take care, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's David Swanson, author, activist, and host of Talk Nation Radio.